afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
All the music comes from Bob. We appreciate it. I have kind of a challenge for you again today on the musical options.
I love a good challenge.
Okay, so for all those of you who followed our serial guest, Peter Friedman, if you followed those shows with him, where we talked about Islam and the Middle East, and I mean, we could have done 50 shows, but we did, I think, 5 right in a row. So he's our serial guest. The only other person we've had on that long was somebody who was on like three weeks, I think. So it's a huge topic. And the whole time during that show, he kept saying, you've got to talk to Frank Burley. He wrote this book. And he kept saying, it's in the book. It's in the book. I mean, that's like I know we always laugh. That's the answer to everything. It's in the book.
And I have to admit, I read the book.
He was completely not kidding.
And I could not put it down.
The book is called It's All About Muhammad. That's the name of the book. So that's what I called our show today, even though I should have called it This Is All the Stuff You Really Need to Know But Don't, because that's the truth.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, it's about Muhammad, but it's about how the Quran was written, what's in the Quran, what and why these people believe what they believe.
From the very, very beginning.
From the very beginning.
It isn't just a bunch of people who now have gone off the rails and are, you know,
misinterpreting things.
Misinterpreting and setting off bombs.
Oh, no.
So I think you guys are going to be riveted. I've listed it all on the site. I guess I should give you some of that information. The website is wethepeopleradio.us. If you have friends, family, or anybody who's interested in this topic, if you go there, there's a distinct page with all the information about the book, and it'll have the archive of the show by 3:30 today, something like that. And so you can send that to friends and family. We have a commercial-free one. All the archive, the full archive, posted by about 2:15. But the commercial-free one's on later, so if you have people who don't want to commit 2 hours, they can commit an hour and a half. But really important information. And I don't know a lot about our guest, and I don't know how much he wants to tell us, but...
I want him to tell everything.
But no, I mean about himself. I don't know much about himself, about his own personal things, and he may not want to share that, but we do want to know that if you want to tell us, Frank. And we kind of want to know what made you start this project.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy to do that.
Start at the beginning.
As far as personal details about me, but all that I will say is I've got a 38 within reach.
You better.
I kind of didn't think there was probably a lot you wanted to put out about your personal life, because I would imagine this
is pretty wild.
Yeah, probably made you pretty unpopular.
Get really, you know, upset, particularly a book like mine, because it's illustrated. You know, it's got 25 illustrations, and they're not mocking or satirical type illustrations. They're just pulled from the literature, showing you know, things that Muhammad did, and they're not very flattering. You know, like mass murdering 700, 800, 900 Jews.
Yeah, all at the same time.
So yeah. So anyway, I thought there would be a really huge backlash because of it, but in fact, nothing in particular occurred. At least not yet. So
that's good.
Anyway. Yeah, so as far as the book goes, what got it going was 9/11. 9/11. Prior to that, you know, I really wasn't all that interested in the subject, and I just dismissed Islam as being, you know, not a religion, but some kind of a mental disease, and let it go at that. You know, but after 9/11, I started thinking about it. You know, what's behind all of this? Why do these people do what they do? And it took a long time to actually get around to doing this project, because, you know, I had to make a living, and it's an enormous subject. So I spent a number of years kind of dabbling in it and then acquiring books. You know, part of my early education in this had to do with finding out what I needed to learn. And it all centered on Muhammad, I mean, very quickly. So I went about, over the years, acquiring a library of about 500 books. About 150 of them have to do with Iran, and the rest have to do with Islam, a lot of them are secondary works, but I acquired all of the original literature of Islam that's available in English. And that includes the collections of traditions about Muhammad, the early biographies and histories and so forth. And what really kicked it off was the publication in 2011 of one of the key books of Islam, which is the book of Books of Raids and Battles of Muhammad by Waqidi. This is a huge volume. It's like 400,000 words. And it is by far the most detailed account anywhere of what he did. 70% of his biography has to do with basically atrocities that he committed against people. And this is that particular book, Waqidi's. It's all in there. So, and that was only available in English translation in 2011.
Wow!
As soon as I had that, I figured, well, it's time to get going on this.
Yeah,
so I allotted 3 years to the project.
Yeah, one of the things you'd mentioned in the book was the fact that so much of the history has not been translated even today.
That's true. There's still a lot other, documents that haven't been introduced yet in English. But all of the foundation work is there now. So that's really the key. You know, like the history of Ibn Ishaq, called The Life of Muhammad. That was translated, I think, in 1955, so it's been around for a while. Very difficult reading, though. Mainly, it's of interest to specialists.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think all of the major literature now is in translation. At least the Sunni side of it. A lot of what the Shias consider important is still, not in English yet. In any event, so I took 3 years to do this project, and it was day in, day out. You know, I went over a lot of this literature line by line. I mean, I scanned it into my computer. I broke everything down into multiple files and mini files and different categories. And what really struck me and started really getting my interest going were the characters. You know, the more I read, really three-dimensional characters. You could really understand them and almost kind of visualize them. Not just Muhammad, but all the people around him and his enemies. So, I did all of this compiling of information as I went along. You know, it's a biography, so, I start from A to go all the way to Z, birth through death. So that's what it took, 3 years, a lot of work.
Yeah, wow. And you did I thought you did a fantastic job when you talk about the characters in the book. There's a lot of names. They get kind of jumbled up after a while. But the main characters, the folks that had influence with him, the folks he surrounded himself with, really kept you glued to the book. It was
every
a great
time,
story.
I mean, Frank, really, every single time, it's like, where's Bill? Oh my gosh, he's in there reading that book again. It was like drugs. Where's Bill? He's reading the book. You know, we had 5 minutes before we had to go somewhere. Bill runs in there. He's got his book.
I think I read it in 5 days. It
was, I've never seen Bill read a book like that.
It was very compelling.
He was riveted. He's like, you're not going to believe it. This part right here.
Well, so much of it is actually
boring,
happening today.
No.
And that's what I think really makes it so riveting is when you read how a lot of these scriptures were written and why they were written and what's happening today as a result of these folks following these Quran scriptures, it makes total sense. So it was a very good read.
So for people who think, I might not want to read a boring book on Muhammad.
It's not boring.
It's not
the way
boring.
I wrote it.
No.
It's not, boring. It's not a novel, but it uses a lot of novelistic techniques. I use a lot of dialogue in there. And none of it's invented, by the way. All of the dialogue is extracted from the literature.
Oh, yeah, and you did a great job with referencing everything in the back of the book. If you want to doubt anything that's in the book, just go to the back.
Right, everything is there. It's 47 pages of double-column chapter notes.
Yes.
I deliberately put in there a lot of the extended quotations from the literature, in part, to give an idea, to support what's in the book, but also to give an idea of the nature of the literature. You can see, without having to acquire these books yourself, basically the tenor of them. So, that ended up being 47 pages long. That's a considerable amount of, that's 23,000 words, it turned out.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, when I first picked it up, it was like, oh, man, it's going to take me forever to read this book because it can't be that compelling. But I'll tell you what, you will go through it in a hurry.
Yeah, well, I wrote it that way to make it readable.
Good idea, because a lot of times let's face it, a lot of times it's not like that. We need to take a really quick break, but when we come back, now, Frank, tell me before we do this, how exactly do I pronounce your last name?
Burley.
It is Burley. Okay. I thought, well, maybe there's some trick thing. I shouldn't use his name incorrectly the whole time. We'd like to hear about Muhammad from the beginning, the part we never, ever hear about. So hang with us, folks. I think you're going to really, really learn a lot. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
Going to be painful but factual. All right, we're here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, and best read you're going to find. You can get that information on Amazon. I've put a link on the website at wethepeopleradio.us, and the archive of the show will be up for you this afternoon, so you can send it to other folks, because it's about time we all got smart on this whole thing. All right, so Frank, take us back to the beginning.
Okay. In the beginning, there was the Word. You want to go that far back? No.
That whole 7-day deal.
Well, Aaron just had a conversation the other day with somebody that didn't know, said he read all about Muhammad, and she popped two questions on him, one about who raised him, and the other one was his epilepsy. Didn't know either one of those. So, I mean, they're
those are important topics.
Huge.
They are.
Okay,
what was Muhammad the kid doing?
Pardon me?
Yeah, Muhammad the boy.
Yeah, well, here's the deal. He was born in Mecca, okay? And he was of the family that, the clan that controlled the temple. And back then, by the way, I don't use the word Kaaba. You'll notice in the book very much. Because Kaaba means cube, which is the shape that it has it today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But back when he was born, the temple was just a rectangular wall of stone without a roof. And it was above the height of a man. And it had all kinds of idols inside and around it, okay? So he was born then into Mecca in 570 A.D., and his family was the family that had the temple duties, and a lot of the duties included feeding and providing water to pilgrims. The pilgrims would come from all over in order to do the rites of the temple and worship whatever idol they wanted. Excuse me, it was very, very eclectic. The Meccans were open to everything. They even had, at a later time, they even had an image of Mary and Jesus in the temple. So, very eclectic. Excuse me. So anyway, he was born, but the family was not that well off. Particularly, his father died either before he was born, just before he was born, or just after. his mother wasn't able to care for him. So within a week of him being born, he was given away to a Bedouin woman to raise, the nurse, basically, that's the way they put it. And she lived a 3 days ride, camel ride, away to the east of Mecca, near the town of Taif. So he didn't have any contact with his biological mother or his family practically until he was 5 years old. And this is all in the literature. You know, I'm only repeating what I found in the literature. And very early, his foster family determined that there was something kind of strange about him, because he had an episode of falling down and having this idea that some angels appeared to him and cut him open and washed him up and other weird things like that. Back then, epilepsy was called the falling sickness, because that's what happens when people have seizures. You know, they lose control of their muscles, sure, and they drop to the ground like a brick. And this happened to him when he was maybe 2 or 3 years old. So, and back then they thought it was devil possession. That's what epilepsy was, possession by the jinn. So they took the boy back to his mother. They wanted to get rid of him, give him back to the mother, but she talked them into keeping him longer. And they did for 2 more years, but then it started getting strange again with him. So they returned to him when he was 5 years old to his mother.
So now, at that point, he didn't even know his mother, and they were strangers. They were strangers.
You have to imagine that this would have been a very traumatic experience for him.
Sure.
Because his mother, as far as he knew, was the Bedouin woman, a woman named Halima. And so, you know, he was tied to her emotionally and to her to her husband and to the other children. So, you know, it must have been an extremely unsettling experience to be returned to a woman he didn't even know. But that's what happened. Then within a year, she died. Then he was turned over to his grandfather. His grandfather was the custodian of the temple, and he had something like 12 children. And he died two years after that. So you could see these series of, excuse me, of emotionally upsetting experiences, one after the other, that had a big role in shaping him psychologically. He was then taken into the home of one of his uncles, Abu Talib, who at one point inherited the duties of the father, of the grandfather, but then passed them off to another brother. He was not very well off. The way I read him from the literature was that he was a good-natured person and a lousy businessman, because he just wasn't able to cut deals that were favorable to him. Other people were sharper than him. So the family was not all that well off. And so Muhammad was raised in poverty, essentially. And at some point, he had to work as a shepherd. So he was out there with herds of goats on the mountainsides surrounding Mecca. And it's a very lowly occupation. That's like the low man on the totem pole when you're a shepherd. So it was humiliating. You can imagine how he felt being at the lowest rung of Meccan society. You know, shepherds weren't taken seriously. They were just people who took care of other people's goats. And so this was the situation. At one point, he went on a trade mission with his uncle, Abu Talib. And from the sound of it, they went up to the Gaza area and to Syria. I don't think it was called Syria back then. It was called Sham, the land of the sun. And then they returned to Mecca, and he got to experience a foreign culture at that point, because that was all Christian at the time. That whole region was Christianized. But they were also Arab, and they spoke the same language.
Frank, what year was this?
Well, he was born in 570, so this would have been like, the trip to Syria would have been like 12 years later.
Right.
So we're talking about 582 A.D.
Right. So the Christian religion was not brand new. I mean, it had been around a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had been... it had spread, and then after Constantine converted to Christianity, which was, I think, the 4th century, then the entire empire became Christianized fairly quickly. Although, you know, there was still... The pagan cults still coexisted there with Christianity.
Right.
But it was, you know, steadily Christianizing, and at that time, it was almost entirely Christian.
Right. And that peninsula, a lot of that peninsula was the polytheist believers, and that's why they had all the different statues and gods and everything at their temples.
Right.
They had,
oh,
they had
and also, you know, it's
gods.
Interesting to note that much of the Hijaz, which is Western... the Wild West of Arabia, where Mecca and Medina are located, was Jewish. Medina, it used to be called Yathrib, and that's the name I prefer to use because that's what it was called back then. Yathrib was half Jewish. Mm-hmm. They had three major Jewish tribes. And then if you go further north, there are these different oases there. They were also Jewish, and they had been settled there for like 1,000 years. So they lived side by side with the polytheists. And to my knowledge, there were never any frictions or wars between tribes over religion there in that area. That only came later. But the Jewish presence was really strong. Really strong. And this is important to the story, too.
Sure, because that was probably his first big influence of an outside religion was on that caravan.
Yeah, and that was to Christianity, too. Mm-hmm. Now, Christianity did not have a big presence in the Hijaz. You did have people going through, and then when they had their annual fairs, you had missionaries who were proselytizing. You know, there was a, you know, like county fairs,
mm-hmm.
you know, today. Same kind of concept, except, you know, they sold slaves, bought and sold slaves, and did all kinds of strange stuff that wouldn't cut it today. But, yeah, they had, you know, missionaries there. And these fairs, by the way, were also noted for their poetry events. Poetry was really big in Arabia. It's a language that lends itself to poetry. And the Arabs really prided themselves on their compositions. So they would have these annual poetry contests. This is important because look at the Quran. This is supposed to be poetry, you know. So that's probably the reason that Muhammad chose, you know, to use verses, poetic verses, rather than just, you know, prose. So that was the background, you know, the religious background back then.
And I think that the why he formed or how he formed his whole religion is really set with that as a backdrop. The, you know, the poly... I don't know if people really understand the polytheist. Maybe when we come back, you could give kind of like a snapshot of what that means and how they practice, since we don't... Obviously, that's really foreign to us at this,
right.
at this point. We probably shouldn't gloss that over, I guess. Kind of important.
You want me to talk about it now, or are you going to go on break or what?
Let's do a really quick break, and then we'll come right back and do that part.
All right.
Okay, thanks. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Waiting in the
Welcome back. We are here with Frank Burley, author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. I think that's the best title ever.
It is.
By the way.
We're talking about Muhammad right now as a boy, makes his first big trip out of Mecca and learns about Christianity or is exposed to Christianity and returns to Mecca. And at that time, Mecca was polytheist. And Frank, tell us about that and why that was such a big deal when he came in and tried to change it all.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, a really good question, and I'm glad you brought it up. The the Meccans were polytheists, and they had quite an array of gods and goddesses and so forth, which was in line with paganism in general, you know, throughout the Middle East and throughout everywhere, you know, even prior to Christianity in Rome, Greece, everywhere. You know, paganism, polytheism was the prevailing way of perceiving, you know, the universe, attributing the different things to gods and goddesses. The Meccans, for example, they had a god called Hubal, who was a moon god. And the temple of Mecca was initially a moon temple. But they also had an array of other, you know, deities that they worshipped. There was a trilogy of goddesses. The principal one was Alat, and then there was Alusa, and then Manat. And the first two, I've been able to sort of understand. Alat was kind of like a fertility goddess. And she was given preeminence in Taif, which was to the east of Mecca, about a three-day camel journey, which is where the region where Muhammad was raised in his early years. You know, it was an agricultural area in the mountains, and so it was natural for them to worship goddess of fertility. And she's got different names throughout, you know, the Levant. But it's basically the same idea, concept. And Alusa, on the other hand, which was a goddess very much favored by the Meccans, was a fertility goddess. And she represented the life force itself, whereas Alat was the reproductivity of nature, fecundity of nature. So this is what, you know, this is the type of belief, and it was very, there was nothing unusual about it for those days, except that, monotheism was spreading. Christianity was on the ascendance, and a lot of the Meccans were, or some of the Meccans, I should say, were starting to question the belief system. And there was a small group of four people. They were called the Seekers. And they formed a little group. And Muhammad's wife, Khadijah, was very much a part of that, because one of her cousins or one of her uncles was one of the Seekers. And so they made a lot of inquiries into Christianity, and in fact, three of them ended up converting to Christianity. And these people were within Muhammad's circle because of his marriage, and we should backtrack a little bit, if you'd like, about that.
Yeah, well, as a child, he came back to this society, and as he grew up, he was exposed to Judaism, Christianity, all their moon gods and all this.
And that wasn't considered bad, right? Was everybody allowed to be whatever they wanted?
Well, by and large, as long as nobody threatened the established order.
Sure.
One of that four was Zaid, and he was kind of a crusty old guy, an in-your-face contrarian. That's how I describe him in the book. And he would really get in people's faces, you know, and tell them that they were on the wrong religion. He was a big on Abraham. And he thought that Abraham had the right idea. There was just one God, and that was all he was ever going to be devoted to, one God. So Zaid was modeled his thinking, which was not very deep, on Abraham. So he was one of the influences on Muhammad. But I'm going astray here a little bit. But Muhammad, after his trip to the north and working as a shepherd and so forth, he became involved in the caravan trade to some extent because of his uncle Abu Talib was involved in the caravan trade, however modestly. So it stands to reason that Muhammad had a role in that.
And it was
not really clarified or gone into in any detail in the literature.
But at that time, Mecca was totally dependent on trade. They didn't. They weren't a seaport. I mean, they had to pretty much get by on these caravans. That's what supported their whole society, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely the truth. You know, it's an arid region, and they couldn't. There were no rivers. They didn't have any agriculture to speak of.
So keeping those trade routes,
they raised goats.
Yeah,
so they got milk and they got meat that way.
So they had to trade with everybody in order to get the goods they needed to flourish where they
Otherwise,
were.
Otherwise, it's milk and goat meat.
Yeah,
and buy food too. I mean, they had to buy wheat and they had to buy barley. They had to buy fruit. You know, so they had to import all that from other areas. And how did they pay for it? from their profits of their trade, yeah.
Right, and it was kind of important for them to get along with everybody so that they had these opportunities to trade with all these other cities.
Yeah, and the Meccan leaders were really clever, too, because they invited all these different tribes all over Arabia to bring their idols to the temple. And that kind of shored up, over time, the Meccan temple as being a center for pilgrimage Arabia. It wasn't the only place that people went to for pilgrimages, but because of that clever strategy, people tended to make Mecca part of their annual pilgrimage. That's not something new that started with Islam. That goes way back. You know, every year there was a pilgrimage period of 3 months. It was such a wild area, you know. The Hijaz means frontier, and it was a lawless, in a sense, a lawless area where there was constant tribal conflict, blood feuds, and so forth. But they had the wisdom to set aside 4 months of the year as sacred months, holy months, where violence was prohibited. So people could travel freely without having to worry about getting killed or whatever, or robbed. So 3 of those months were dedicated to the pilgrimage period. And during that time, they'd also go to their fairs and so forth. But then the terminus of that would be going to a particular, temple. So like I said, Mecca became very important in that circuit because of the fact that they imported all of these different tribal gods.
That was pretty good idea.
And they left the images outside the temple, and some were inside or even on the roof. So, that was really important to the development of Mecca as a commercial center.
So, as he grew up, he was involved in the trade to a certain extent. I mean, he wasn't a caravan owner or anything like that, but he worked for his uncle and grew up in the trade industry, so he understood kind of how things worked.
Yeah.
And then he
was also, by the way, before I forget, a kind of a layabout. Probably a little lazy, and maybe a dreamer because of his epilepsy, who knows, but he gets scolded by his uncle at one point, that he's got to start earning his keep and standing on his own feet. This is
right.
In the literature, I'm not making it up. So he arranges him to be the trade representative for a prominent woman in town, Khadijah, who was a businesswoman. And she had inherited her business from her father, and she knew the ins and outs of it, and she was very successful,
And he was how old?
An alpha woman.
Yeah, she was much older.
Huh? She was older, like 15 years older than him. So the uncle arranged for him to be her trade rep. And so he went to Syria on a trade mission and came back with some good money. And, you know, the literature is full of this nonsense of miracles and so forth. And so the way it's described in the book, when he comes back from the trade mission, you know, the camel caravan's coming into town. They pass in front of the temple. There's like an administrative building for the city right across from the temple. And people are milling around there, and all the camels are coming in. And he trots his camel up to Khadijah's house. And she and her companion see an angel hovering over him. So she was smitten, because the whole of Arabia was awash in talk about a prophet coming, the coming prophet. And here he was, coming towards her house, with an angel hovering over him. It's part of the nonsense that comes through in that literature. So anyway, the long and short of it is they end up getting married. And they have, you know, a bunch of children. If the literature is to be believed, they had six children. But there's some questions about that.
And
she may have had children from a prior marriage.
And he's how old at this point?
And then a second husband died. But she was a big influence on him. For one, she was wealthy. And so his status went from being, you know, near the bottom and to near the top, like overnight. So that was really important for him, an important development for him. And another important thing about that was that she was linked to this circuit of dissenters. So she may have been introduced to Christianity and may have learned something about it, although she was raised a polytheist too. But the key thing there is that she would have brought Muhammad into that circle of people who are questioning the validity of their polytheistic beliefs. So he was introduced by the time he was, maybe later, probably by the time he was 30 years old, this didn't happen overnight, to these kinds of people and to their ideas. So that's very important for his, you know, intellectual development.
Mm-hmm. Well, he, at that point, is just getting started. We need to take a really quick break here before the top of the hour, and we're going to come right back. We, just in case you're afraid we're not going to be able to finish the story about Muhammad's upbringing, we roped Frank into being on with us next week, too. So we're taking some time to do this background in detail, probably more detail than we'd have a chance to do if we were trying to cram it all into one program. But promise we won't leave you hanging. Anyway, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. You've got all the information about the book and everything else at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'll keep my freedom. I'll keep my guns. Try to keep my money and my religion too. Try to keep on working. Try to keep on smiling. I will keep my Christian name, and y'all can keep the change.
Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Ah, the music. We swing, we swing wildly.
There's no reason we can't all just get along.
No, exactly. All right, we don't want to hog up any time.
Yeah, Frank.
Bill had questions, needs.
So when, he's back in Mecca now. He's learning about religion. When was he first, or when did he first believe he was spoken to by God and felt that he was the messenger?
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, this could drag out being, you know, too much detail. I don't want to bore anybody with this. But before we get to that, I gotta, you know, inject something about epilepsy again. He had some more episodes of falling down that you can find in the literature, and of course they don't attribute it to epilepsy, but there's something divine about it for them. But once one of the important ones happened when he was part of the reconstruction crew of the temple. And this is an important development in Mecca because, like I said, the temple before then did not even have a roof. But it suffered some damage from a flash flood, and so they decided they needed to reconstruct it. And this would have been about 605 A.D., so Muhammad would have been 35 years old. And the way they used to work on construction projects like that, they would strip and use their waistcloth as a cushion to carry rocks on their shoulder so they don't, you know, cut or bruise their shoulder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Muhammad, he was morbidly modest, and his uncle and other relatives pestered him to take off his clothes, you know, and do like everybody else. So he did it, and then he fell down. He fell down. He had a seizure.
And that's typically brought on by stress, is that right?
Well, that could be part of it, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of course, you know, the Muslims interpret it differently, but falling sickness is falling sickness. You suddenly fall down, you're frothing from the mouth. By God, you've got epilepsy. So, you know, he had episodes like that. So, lo and behold, when he was 40 years old, there was a cave up on one of the mountains there, just outside of town, that looked down on Mecca. If you got up to the top of it, you could look down, and there was the temple, and there was, you know, the town. So he had this little hideaway, and this is where his alleged communion with God happened. So where an angel supposedly appeared to him and told him to read some verses that he had, that the angel had. And so he did that. And in the literature, you know, he's really spooked. He's kind of like, you know, Scrooge after seeing Marley's ghost.
Mm-hmm.
He runs down the mountain, runs home, jumps into bed, just like Scrooge, you know, shaking. And his wife has to, you know, console him. And but she is kind of complicit in convincing him that it was a visitation from God through an angel, and that it meant that he was a prophet.
And he is how old at this point?
He was 40 years old at that point.
So
by
falling,
then he had already been introduced to, you know, Christianity and Christian ideas, and he
sure.
had had some Jewish context, too, of a different kind of, you know, not Jewish scholars, but people who were familiar with Jewish legends. So, starting from that point, like there was a three-year period where he came out with some verses. It wasn't a huge output, but during that time, he you know, began laying the foundation.
But he was illiterate, wasn't he?
Pardon me?
Wasn't he illiterate?
Well, I would say he's probably semi-literate. A lot of the people around him, like Khadija, could read, and she made sure that her children could read, learn to read.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was dyslexic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, dyslexia, like 30% of epileptics are dyslexic. So.
I did not know that.
All right,
so
Frank,
probably,
we're going to,
you know, related to his epilepsy.
Right. We're going to take a hard break top of the hour here, but when we come back, let's pick it up where he's now been contacted by an angel, and he's the man. He's the next prophet.
That's right.
And we're gonna pick it up there.
This Sunday, it's all about Muhammad. Next Sunday, too, as a matter of fact. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon.
I'm trying to train myself from stop saying good morning. I have been on in the morning for a long time, and I just, it was always good morning. Anyway, you're listening to the second hour of We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And when one of us is missing, everything goes, you know,
it's just not good. Yeah.
Requires all three of us to make it happen. So we are in the throes of discussing a book called It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. And I think in light of what's going on in the world today, the author Frank Burley has a tremendous amount of light to shed on current events. How about that? We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right, boys, pick it up where we left off.
We were talking about Muhammad. He's in Mecca. He's approximately, I don't know, 35, 40 years old now. And he's been, now he's convinced that he was touched by an angel in one of his epileptic seizures, which I think is important to know because that was one of the things that, in fact, Aaron had a conversation last week with somebody who was a supposed expert on Muhammad, didn't know he had epilepsy.
Yeah.
And much of the writings in the Quran were written after he had one of these seizures, although I think you mentioned that some of it was probably written previous, and then he made it public after he came out of his seizure, like it was another message from God. But so he's been touched by an angel. Where does he go from here?
Yeah, well, there's an important detail for people who are deniers that he had epilepsy. It's in the literature where when he fell down, when he had his supposed experience with an angel, he fell down, and the angel had filled the entire sky and then came down to human size and wiped saliva off his cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Wiped saliva off his cheek. That is a key telling detail because
yeah.
When people have a seizure, they fall down, and then they tend to swallow their tongue, so saliva spills out of their mouth.
Right.
And it could look kind of frothy. So here's a detail, a total giveaway in their own literature. Wipe saliva off his cheek.
And did he at
anyway,
this point?
That's an important.
Did he at this point name
way to get around it? You know, he was an epileptic, by God.
So
in epileptics. This is important to point out. People with epilepsy, with a certain type of epilepsy, temporal lobe epilepsy, which apparently is what he had,
mm-hmm.
a significant number of them have these experiences where they feel like they're in communion with the divine. And the researchers who look into this and who interview these people as a part of their studies are really stunned by how firmly people cling to that idea that they're somehow mystically connected.
Right.
So, you know, it's nothing unusual for people with temporal lobe epilepsy to have auditory and visual hallucinations and so forth, even olfactory hallucinations.
Now,
so this is what was happening with Muhammad. He misinterpreted it.
And did he know what angel?
Yeah, he said it was Angel Gabriel.
So a Christian
eventually,
angel.
I don't know if he said it at that time, but eventually that became the story.
Right.
And so it all starts from there. Now, the problem with Muhammad wasn't that he had epilepsy. A lot of people have epilepsy, even today, although today you can control it with drugs. But he was also a psychopath. This is something that most people don't want to understand, I think. This guy was really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to determine exactly, you know, when or how his psychopathy formed. But it certainly had to do with his early life experiences. And there was probably more done to him than is ever revealed in the literature. That was a pretty brutal society back then. And child abuse was rampant, just like it is in Muslim countries today. So that always is a factor in the formation of psychopathic personalities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Child abuse, emotional, physical. So we really don't know everything that went into the formation of his character. But, you know, the later developments where he mass murders people and sends hitmen to kill people who criticize him and so forth, you know, that's got an origin. Normal people don't behave that way. So after, this is starting to emerge, though, after he comes out declaring himself to be a prophet, his psychopathic side, although it's controlled and contained while he's still in Mecca.
Yeah, he had enough forethought not to step too far outside the lines at this point because he didn't have any following.
Zaid, I mentioned him earlier. One of the four seekers was an in your face type of guy, and he got run out of town mainly because he was so uncompromising. Well, Muhammad turned out to be the same way. He was very uncompromising. At first, he didn't attack the Meccan beliefs. He just talked about what he believed to be the truth. And they left him alone. I mean, like, so what? Okay, that's interesting. But then he started attacking the Meccan belief system itself. Then the Meccans became really furious with him. He kept it up, and he was making a handful of converts by that time. And some of them were children of notable Meccans. Others were slaves and, you know, people, freedmen and so forth. There weren't many of them, maybe a couple dozen. So, including Khadijah and his wife and his first cousin, Ali. Ali's a very important character. But the Meccans at that point started bristling, and it got to the point where they went to Abu Talib and they told him, you know, tell your nephew to knock it off. And Muhammad didn't knock it off. So it came to the point where the Meccans went to Abu Talib and told him, look, if he doesn't stop, we're going to have to kill him. And they wanted permission, Abu Talib's permission to kill him. This is because in that kind of a society, a tribal society, you know, if you kill somebody, there's reprisal from the offended party, the affected family, which in this case was an entire clan. Now, Mecca at that time was formed of a number of prominent clans that all belonged to the Quraysh tribe. But they all coexisted there in Mecca. Now, if they went ahead and killed Muhammad, then they would have a civil war on their hands because it would be his clan against all the other clans. His clan would be honor-bound to take revenge, you see, and that would create a cycle of violence, and the Meccans didn't want that. So they needed to get permission from Abu Talib to do it, and Abu Talib wouldn't give them permission. So so the tension started rising. And this is in the Quran, you see a lot of entries where, you know, Muhammad repeats what the Meccans are saying about him. Of course, he's attributing all of this to God, you know.
Now, is he writing poetry at this point? And is that part of why they're becoming a little upset? Is because
that's part of it, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's coming out with these verses claiming they come from God. And the Meccans laugh at him. They ridicule him. And, of course, you ridicule a psychopath, you're gonna pay for it.
And these verses, at this point, are some of the verses that are found in the Quran.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he's already started
superiors to the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Peter Friedman covered this earlier in one of his broadcasts with you, but there are two divisions of the Quran. There was the Meccan Quran, which tends to be more peaceful, and then the Medina Quran, which, you know, is full of all of these god-awful calls for violence. But while he was in Mecca, he had to be really cautious. You know, he didn't have enough backing to where he could protect himself if it came to violence. So he didn't really unleash the violence until later. But, you know, there was a lot of tension growing. And at some point it became so great that his followers migrated to Abyssinia, which is now Ethiopia. They had to go across the Red Sea. So but his Quran was evolving at that time and developing. He was coming out with more verses all the time and attributing them to God. There's a couple things that should be noted about his Quran style. He uses the God voice. You know, is supposed to be interpreted as God talking. He has to use that device because if he used the word I, you know, God talking in his own voice, it could be confusing to the person listening to the...
And that's
the
really important.
Right?
Yeah, that's really important. And I think people, that's one of the reasons people were getting a little bit upset with him was because of that God voice he's using in his writings, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could imagine it's kind of condescending. You know, here's this guy that's married to a rich woman and doesn't owe much of his status to his own efforts, but to her. Talking down to him as if God's talking. You could imagine people getting pretty worked up over that. And then another feature of the Quran, which is really interesting to know, is that occasionally he gives himself authority to speak in his own voice. And that's preceded by the word say, S-A-Y, say. So he's having God instruct him to say something in his own voice at that point. so then he can talk in his own voice.
Right.
And you see a lot of entries in the Quran like that.
Which that, again, gives him a lot of power.
Yeah, well, God's authorizing him to talk.
Sure.
So, I mean, we're getting into Looney Tune territory here, I tell you. It's unfortunate it turned so violent because that's plaguing the world today. It's totally, you know, a mental, it's a neurological illness which is at work here, along with psychopathy. And the tensions grow because he won't give any ground whatsoever until later, a little bit later, a couple years later. The pressures get so great that he finally composes a verse that allows the Meccans to worship their three goddesses, Alat, Alausa, and Manat. And this is what's called the Satanic Verses, by the way. Muhammad was under extreme pressure. A lot of his followers, I think it was just after a lot of them migrated to Ethiopia, to Abyssinia, you know, because of the persecution that was taking place. And the persecution being, you know, not nailing people to crosses, but it was mainly the Meccans making people really uncomfortable who were followers of Muhammad. There was some violence against some of the lower order followers, like slaves and so forth. But Muhammad gave them permission at one point to leave. And this is around the time when these Satanic Verses came out. He was under a lot of pressure. And so he came up with this verse that was like a concession to the Meccan belief system. Up until that time, he reviled all of their beliefs totally.
But he was...
There was only one God.
But he was nonviolent.
Anything other than God in God's place was a violation in contempt of God.
But most of what he was writing was still of the nonviolent type of writings.
And,
is that right?
But wait, and was he actually writing this himself?
Or did he have a scribe?
The Quran?
Yeah, didn't he have a scribe?
Well, not at this point, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't think so. He was composing. These people had terrific memories because they had to rely on their memories rather than on writing. And so they developed their memories to a great extent, much more than anybody does today. So they could compose verses and then remember them. And then people could hear them, and then after maybe hearing them a few times, repeat them verbatim.
Sure. Just like we got through Dark Ages and everything else, it was all done with stories and...
Yeah, it was very oral, an oral society.
Yeah, exactly. We better take a really quick break, or we're going to be snowballed here at the end. We're running a little bit late. Our guest is Frank Burley. We're speaking about his book, It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. And just a compelling, compelling read. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back.
So many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. I walk into an empty room.
Having a seizure.
could be just spitting foam on your chest. So
okay,
Frank,
sorry.
We're gonna move on here. He's in Mecca. He's basically got the powers that be there a little bit angry at him. They want to kill him. They can't kill him. They really don't know what to do with him. So doesn't he kind of start scouting around and kind of looking at other options before he actually left?
Let me fast forward this because, there's it's a long story, a little bit too long for a radio program.
Yeah, people are going to buy the book when they want the details, but...
they should buy my book because it's all there.
Yes, it is.
Read the book!
The tension kept on building up, and he was... getting threatening, and a lot of his conversations that he has with Meccans turns up in the Quran, which it really shows it's like a blog, you know. The Quran is like a blog to some extent, and he comments on the happenings of the day in the blog, in the Quran. He was probably the world's first blogger, so you can see things happening and being said to him in Mecca by Meccans, and then he comments on them in the Quran. You know, here, in his scheme of things, right, you know, God dispatches the angel Gabriel, you know, to come to him to whisper these sweet nothings of Quran verses to him, all right? I mean, this is how loony this is. You know, we have this vast universe that now they believe there's something like 20 trillion galaxies out there, and God's going to take time out to whisper all this stuff to Muhammad. I mean, it's totally loony. But, this is what he was pushing, you know. And he had it, by the way, he followed the cosmogony of the day, which held that there were seven levels of heaven, and then above heaven was the throne of God. And he said that the throne of God was above the Kaaba in Mecca. So in his view of things, the throne of God was in geosynchronous orbit around the earth. That's what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
So God comes to him via the angel Gabriel and tells him all this stuff. It gets the Meccans really upset. And at some point they decide they needed to kill him no matter what, because he was undermining their society. You know, by then he had 150 followers, and he was starting to have influence outside of Mecca. People were coming to him to ask about the religion from out of town. So they decided to kill him. And the way they wanted to do it, to avoid a civil war, was for a member of each of the clans to participate in the killing. So they would each
have equal guilt
with their sword.
Right.
They would have a shared responsibility for it. So if, if Muhammad's clan wanted to take revenge, they'd have to take revenge on everybody. So anyway, Muhammad got wind of it. Yeah, he had his intelligence network set up, and so anything that happened, he got wind of it. He was very good at intelligence gathering, really good. So he escaped. He escaped before they could kill him. They were going to hit him at his home. And what he did was to disguise himself, and then he fled out of town, but to the south. By then, he had already established a foothold in Medina, in Yathrib. People had come to him a couple years earlier about his religion, and he got them to accept it. And they created a base for him in Medina. So when he decided to flee, that's where he was going to go. And he fled with his chief sidekick, Abu Bakr, who eventually became the first caliph of Islam. And they fled south of town, thinking that the Meccans would search the north area, because it was the north exit that takes you to Medina, which was about 200 miles north. And then they stayed in a cave for a few days while the Meccans did a dragnet looking for him.
Yeah, they were after him. They were going to do him in.
Yeah, they were going to kill him. But, he was well hidden. Then after 3 days, they left via a very circuitous route going towards the Red Sea and then up north. And then finally they ended up in Yathrib, now known as Medina. And this is where the violent episodes of Islam begin, right there.
And this is where his message of peace and, a peaceful transition to his religion changes. And all of a sudden, God starts giving him some different instructions.
Yeah. Yeah, his psychopathy comes to the surface here. It's like lava coming to the surface. You know, it's all hot stuff and it's ready to blow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he the first thing he does when he gets to Medina is to create a mosque. This becomes his Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda means base, so it's his base of operations, his headquarters. It's also a prayer area and a recruiting area and a training area and indoctrination center. And it took 7 months to complete it. And when it was completed, then he started attacking Meccan caravans. He may have started even before then, but I think it really took off after the mosque was completed. That was like the first order of business.
And this was with the support of the people in Medina.
Yes, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by then maybe he had 300 people who were believers in Medina, but it was a large agricultural valley of about 20,000 people. Half of them were Jewish. The Jews made up half the population, and they were divided into three major tribes. So this is where the violence started. He started raiding Meccan caravans in order to pay them back for rejecting him, and also to try to raise money, because he needed to pay his people off. You know, there were a lot of Meccans that came with him who were now indigent. They had to leave everything behind, and he thought it was only right to go after a Meccan caravan.
And this is when he developed his system of payment as part of the loot. He would divide it up amongst the people that participated, keeping a fair portion for himself. But this was a big incentive for folks to join him, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The promise of booty, you know, was a big recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
He kept 20% for himself. That was his cut.
Right.
And but it became the policy. So that was how he recruited people to go on these raids. At first, it was mainly Meccans, Meccan expatriates. And there were about like seven raids. Most of them failed. You know, and Muhammad led a few of them, but the others were led by some of his prominent followers. It came to a battle, the Battle of Badr. This is an important battle in the whole story because what happened was that the Meccans had a major caravan coming back from Syria. And the value of all the merchandise and the gold that they were carrying back was something like 50,000 dinars, which are gold coins. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah, they go a long way to helping the cause.
Yeah, absolutely. So he wanted to get his hands on that. He had spies that had told him that it was going north, and but it basically eluded him on the way north. But it was coming back south at some point. So he had spies planted where they would notify him when the caravan was spotted. So when that happened, this was about like 623 A.D., maybe the year after he got to Medina. He formed a small army of 300 men. Many of them were, you know, were from Medina at that point, with the promise of booty. So they went after the caravan. Now, the people in the caravan, when they were in Syria, were notified that Muhammad had been tracking them and stalking them on their trip north, and to beware on the way back because he was going to go after them. So they sent word to Mecca, and the Meccans raised an army of about 1,000 people. And they headed north. And it was a long trip, like it's 200 miles or so, and they're, you know, a heavy-equipped army. It takes some time to get that far. But Muhammad didn't know it until the last moment. He was going after the caravan, but the caravan already knew what his intentions were. And it was led by one of the major Meccans at the time, Abu Sufyan. He took the caravan towards the Red Sea and then went south along the Red Sea coast. So he was able to avoid Muhammad. and his army. But the about the same time, the Meccan army arrived. And this was in a valley called Badr, where there was a, it was an oasis. And caravans would go there. It was like a major crossroads. Because the road there would go south to Mecca or north to Medina or up the Red Sea towards, you know, towards Syria. And this is where the Meccan caravan was supposed to go. That's where Muhammad went. And at the same time he got there, this is about the same time that the Meccan army got there. And so there was a battle. Now, it just so happened that despite the superiority in numbers, the Meccans lost. All of their leadership was killed. The Muhammad threw their bodies down a well. He took a lot of captives. Some of them he beheaded. A couple of them were people that insulted him in Mecca. One man had that he beheaded had thrown camel intestines on his back while he was praying in front of the temple of Mecca at one point. And he never forgave him for that. So he was one of the captives, and Muhammad had him beheaded.
And now was the caravan got away, though, didn't it?
Yeah, the caravan got away. The caravan made a safe passage all the way to Mecca by diverting, you know, from the course that had been...
So as far as booty, there wasn't a lot other than maybe the military hardware they captured from...
Yeah, exactly. Other than that, their encampment, their tents, a lot of their camels, and, you know, the bulk of the army managed to escape. What really made the thing go in Muhammad's direction was another epileptic fit. This is in the literature, and they don't see it this way, but that's exactly what it was. But he starts having a seizure right when the battle lines are forming. Here you've got, on one side, you've got the 300 of Muhammad's people forming their lines. You know, they got bows and arrows and spears and whatnot. And then on the other side, out of arrow range, they got this, you know, distance between themselves. You had the Meccan army. Now, when the battle lines were forming, just prior to the battle, he had a fit. He went up to a little hut that he had erected, and here he's going through his seizure, and Abu Bakr is with him. Now, before his seizure, he's praying for, you know, feverishly to try to stave it off, but it's coming on him really quick, and then he goes into his fit, and it's uncertain how long it lasts, but when he comes out of it, he's all hyped up, you know? He's seen angels. They're up there in the sky. They're coming down on horses, you know, and they're all dressed in white, all of these angels, and they've got their swords raised high. So he goes, runs out of his hut, and he's telling all of his people about the arrival of these angelic reinforcements. So that really, you know, supercharges them. Before then, they were, you know, basically crapping in their pants, you know, because of the numerical superiority of the Meccans. But here, now they had this belief that they were being reinforced by angels. And so, because of that, they were extremely ferocious, and they beat the Meccans.
And you had mentioned in the book that one of the reasons they became so successful in a lot of these battles was they were absolutely fanatical about this new religion, whereas their enemy wasn't. I mean, they weren't, like, totally committed to dying over this thing. I mean, they'd fight, but they didn't have the...
But it wasn't a... They weren't all in, as they
said.
Yeah,
they weren't quite all in like the Islam was.
Hey, you know what? We're way late here. I've been on the little chat room here. We need to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back with Frank Burley, author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. I think you'll like it. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us for any more information on that, and for the archive of the program, links to the book.
Well.
So we have this big battle, Frank. And what were the I guess the far-reaching implications of his victory? I mean, it wasn't just he won; it really kind of changed a lot of things, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was really pumped up at that point. It was a major victory, and when he returned to Mecca. That's when he started turning on the Jews. And this is really getting into some of the major atrocities that he committed. I should backtrack just a little bit, in that in Mecca, he composed quite a lot of verses, a lot of chapters, surahs they call them, having to do with the prophets. And his material came from Judaism, these prophet stories primarily.
Right, and he...
But not from the Torah, not from the first five books of the Bible. This is what most people don't even understand. Probably most scholars are too dense to even understand this, but his influence were the legends of the Jews, the legends of the Jews about the prophets. The legends are like folktale elaborations of the prophets, stories found in the Torah or Torah, whichever, however it's pronounced. The legends are folktales. The folktales are the major influence for Muhammad for his prophet stories that come out in the Quran. So when he gets to Medina, the bulk of these types of verses and chapters were already composed. So the Jews at first were interested in him because of his claims to be a prophet, and a lot of the rabbis visited him, and they had long discussions. And so he would whip out his prophet stories. The Jews, they listened lightly at first, but they realized that his, versions were not from the Torah, so how could they be, given to him by God.
Well, also, Frank, I don't mean to interrupt, but his earlier versions, a lot of the writings were pointed at the Jews to help bring them into his fold, and part of that was when they kneeled down and did their prayers, they faced Jerusalem at first, and that changed, didn't it?
Yeah, he was trying to get them to accept him as their prophet. And so this is why they had a lot of meetings with rabbis and so forth. But they listened to him, and they realized that, that he was coming from a different direction. Not only did they realize that he was using their legends, but he had even modified them. What he did, basically, he created an epic tale about himself as being somebody God talked to. And in this, he was the hero of the story. So all of the modified versions of the prophet stories have him as the center of the story, and basically being repudiated. Prophets were all repudiated by the Jews. This was this was sort of like the hallmark of being a prophet, a Judaic prophet, is that the Jews rejected them and killed them. This is what he claimed. And so he was being rejected by the Meccans. Therefore, that was proof that he was a prophet, right? So anyway, the Jews of Medina listened to him, and they realized that he was full of baloney. And when he started insisting that they accept him as their prophet, they started ridiculing him. And so, same pattern that happened with the Meccans, of him, demanding that they adopt his religion and the resistance that created, the same pattern was happening now in Medina with the Jews. So when he came back from the Battle of Badr, you know, he's all pumped up. And within a month, he's telling one of the Jewish tribes, the one that was closest to where his mosque was, about a mile or two away. He actually went to their synagogue and told them, look, you know, I'm your prophet whether you accept it or not. I'm the prophet of God, believe it or not. And so he gave them an ultimatum, you know, to bow down to him, basically, and accept him. But they refused. So he came up with a pretext. One of the verses that he came up with after the Battle of Badr authorized him to repudiate a treaty if there was any hint of treason or treachery on the part of the person with whom there was a treaty. This was a real convenient verse. It's in chapter 8, Surah 8. And what happened was that he used that. In fact, he probably composed it on the spot in order to give him a justification for attacking the Jews.
And that became kind of a habit.
Yeah, and it was just a stupid little incident where at the marketplace in front of the Jewish fortress there, they had a plaza, you know, a square marketplace. Somebody pinned the skirt up of some Jewish, of some, you know, believer, one of the believers. She had been there trying to sell some gold trinkets or whatever. And somebody pinned up her skirt so that when she stood up, you know, her butt was exposed. Anyway, it turned into a little fight where one of the Jews got killed, and then the Jews killed the guy that killed the Jew. And so Muhammad used that as a pretext.
Eye for an eye.
But they had repudiated the treaty and shown signs of treachery. And so he attacked them. He surrounded the fortress. He sent out word, you know, that there was booty in the air. So he got a lot of recruits. And about 700 people from Medina joined in the siege. And it lasted for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks. Finally, the Jews gave up. Muhammad wanted to behead every one of them. That was his intention. But one of their allies was the leader of one of the major polytheist tribes, the Khazraj. And he confronted Muhammad. In fact, he even grabbed him by his tunic and said, look, leave them alone. They're my allies. You know, you got no right to do this. And Muhammad was just about bursting, you know, well, his blood vessels. He had when he got really angry, his face turned red and his veins in his forehead throbbed, so he was getting to that point there. But he finally relented and let him go, but they had to leave Yathrib. They had to leave Medina, where they had been for 1,000 years. He forced them out. He let them take their personal possessions, but he stripped them of their weapons. And then when they left, he divided up all of their properties. These were mainly merchants and artisans, as opposed to the other two tribes, which were heavily into Jewish tribes, who had date plantations and barley fields and so forth. So this was the first expulsion of the Jews, the beginning of the end for the Jews of Medina, who made up half the population. He forced them out and took over their properties. It set the pattern.
Yeah,
this
that's
came only a month after the defeat at Badr of the Meccans.
And that really set the stage for future wealth, future attacks, because that was somewhat profitable for him to take over that fort, take all their land, and these were large forts. I mean, they had a lot of livestock and stuff they didn't haul off on their camels, so it was pretty profitable for him.
Oh, yeah. And I found a picture, a photograph somewhere, I don't know where it is now, but of that fortress, of the Kureisa fortress. It was the, not the Kureisa, but it was the Kanuka Jews. And it's perched on top of the slope that leads up to upper Medina. The Medina's is a large valley, but there's a lowland and a highland. And this particular Jewish tribe occupied the very beginnings of the highland. And you can see this fortress, what's left of it, is like, you know, four stories high. It's really an imposing-looking structure. These fortresses were very common then because there were a lot of tribal wars. So it was natural for tribes to have some kind of a defense, so they would build these huge fortresses. And then in times of trouble, all of the people of the tribe would go into that one major fortress. You know, they would have access to water and then stores of provisions. So in a siege situation, it was just a matter of waiting them out until they didn't have any more food. So then they either died of starvation or they gave up. That was the idea. So this Jewish tribe finally gave up and agreed to Muhammad's terms. But he wanted to behead them all. That's in the literature. And the only reason he didn't do it is because of the intervention of this particular pagan leader, who was one of their allies. This is a holy man. This is a holy man. This is what the Muslims consider to be a holy man. This is holy behavior. I take a good close look at what's really in their literature. But they don't. You know what? One of the biggest things that people don't realize about Muslims is that most Muslims don't know anything about any of this. It's not just non-Muslims who are ignorant about this, but most Muslims are ignorant about this.
Well, it's kind of like
down their throat.
It seems, you know, like other religions, though they pick up what they want to hear, and then they beat you over the head with it. They don't really look at the whole thing. I was really kind of amazed at the level of information in this book. And where it came from. I mean, this isn't, you're not making it up. I mean, this is all their own writings, and it really makes sense why the things that are happening today are happening.
They all follow his example. This is an important concept. Everybody should understand this. The word is called Sunna, S-U-N-N-A. That is the Arabic word for example. Or for precedent, something like that. It's got a lot of meanings, but this is all part of Muhammad's Sunnah. Sunnah, his example, the example of his behavior. Now, Muslims are obligated to follow not only the Quran, but Muhammad's Sunnah. This is where the Sunnis get their name from. They are the followers of the ways of Muhammad, which includes all the atrocities that he committed.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because was something you'd mentioned was the difference between the Shia and the Sunnis and why that is such a major rift. Touch on that a little bit, the difference between what they believe and you know, much of it is around what Muhammad said came from God and what didn't.
Well, you know, actually the Sunni and Shia split had to do with control of Islam more than dogma. Although over time there was some, you know, a bigger rift. But basically the Shias, they believe about Muhammad what the Sunnis believe. I mean, the Sunnis don't dismiss any of the biographical materials about Muhammad that I know of, you know.
But they're
all bona fide Islam for them. But the big split between the Shias and the Sunnis occurred later. Over the control of Islam after Muhammad died. His first cousin was Ali. Ali was raised in his household. The people who were supporters of Ali believed that he should be the successor to Muhammad after Muhammad died. But it turned out that this clique of Meccans that included Abu Bakr and Uthman and Umar, they were all from different clans. They weren't from Muhammad's clan, but Ali was. He was a son of Abu Talib. That made him a first cousin of Muhammad. But after Muhammad's death, it was the Meccan faction that took over. So Abu Bakr became the first caliph, then came Umar, and then came Uthman. And Ali finally was allowed in, but by then there were civil wars and fighting over who should rule.
Right, so one side believed you had to be a direct descendant of Muhammad. The other side believed in more of a democratic rule. You didn't have to actually be in the bloodline.
Yeah, the bloodline is important for the Shias. Yeah, that's it. You put your finger on it right there. Yeah, that's what they. That's where the split essentially resides in, bloodline. So, and they've been at war ever since, you know.
Right.
They kill each other off all the time. They do it right now.
Right. And, you know, that was, I find that interesting because I didn't realize that was really kind of the main focal point of why they don't get along. And when you think about that, really, no matter what we do over there, you're not going to change that thinking. So how are you going to stop these two factions from killing each other when it comes to
control? Well, you don't, actually. I think, you know, what our policy is that we don't know about is to encourage the Shias and the Sunnis to massacre each other. I think
right.
I think that's what's happening now. We, in our bizarre way, you know, even Obama's getting, you know, manipulated into creating this kind of a condition where the Sunnis and the Shias slaughter each other. As long as they're killing each other, maybe they'll leave everybody else alone. But there's a lot of collateral damage, like all these Muslims going into Europe now. But listen, let me be frank with you. The only cure for Islamic terror is to get rid of Islam, period. There's no such a thing as moderate Islam.
No. Although there are...
Will
there
be
are
moderated. It's not, it cannot be moderated because it's all about Muhammad.
Right.
It's all about his sunnah. It's all about his claim that God dictated the Quran to him. And this is what Muslims are marinated in from the moment of birth.
Right, right.
So it doesn't matter if a lot of them would not participate in violence, per se, but neither do they deplore it. You don't hear them condemning terrorism. It's very rare that a Muslim will step forward and condemn Islamic terror.
Well, you learn about the things in your book, it starts to make sense of why. Okay, so I told you 2 hours to go away pretty quickly.
Yeah, he did.
Uh-huh. And you were worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about. Sure. Okay, so we have you as our hostage for next week as well.
Okay, well, listen, I hope I haven't bored your audience with
no.
all the details.
No.
We didn't get a chance. Peter Friedman's on the line. He wanted to say hi to you, and we didn't get a chance to do all that because you couldn't hear us part of the time. But next week we're going to start on exactly at noon or 12:05, and we'll get off the ground running.
Terrific.
Thank you very much. Our guest has been Frank Burley. His book, It's All About Muhammad, which is also the name of the website. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. See you next week.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. Bye, Peter.